Peace Talks, a series of programs investigating how we can make peace and pursue nonviolent solutions to conflict within ourselves, our families, our communities, and our world. Feminist author Barbara G. Walker wrote this prayer: "Kindly Mother, give your daughters power to prevent aggressive destruction, to establish your laws of peace and kinship. Help women raise their children with teachings of peace. Help men resist the myths of glory in conflict. Help us all to respect life more than conquest." Today on Peace Talks, Preventing Domestic Violence.
I'm Suzanne Kreider. It's estimated that an act of domestic violence occurs every 18 seconds in the United States, and that between 20 to 30% of all women in this country have been abused by an intimate partner at some point in their adult lives. Domestic violence impacts the survivors, 95% of whom are women and their children. It also impacts the offenders and really all of us in society. Today on Peace Talks, we want to get a better understanding of the warning signs that a relationship is heading toward violence. We'll also hear about treatment approaches that some believe are effectively reducing the reoccurrence of domestic violence, and we'll explore ways that all of us can support the pursuit of peaceful, intimate relationships. Our guests are Barbara Lambert, director of Choosing Harmony, a batterer treatment program in Gallup, New Mexico, and Ann Cass, a retired judge who served in Albuquerque's family courts for 18 years. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara, the statistics I just quoted are very disturbing. Is there any reason for hope? Do you see domestic violence offenders turning themselves around?
I do. It takes a long time. There's a lot of hope, and we have to get the community involved, the police, the justice system. We need to get next-door neighbors involved.
All right. So before we go into the details of your program and how it works, let's spend some time understanding domestic violence. And experts say that domestic violence is really about power and control. It's not about anger. So how can you explain the difference, and how do we see in a relationship or from outside a relationship the difference between power and control versus anger?
If it were about anger, the anger would be generalized. They would be angry at their bosses. They would get angry at other people in their lives. But most of the perpetrators of domestic violence don't get angry at other people. It is their intimate partners who they want to dominate and control. And it looks like anger, but that's not the thing that's triggering it.
How do I know in a relationship, what are some of the early signs of power and control?
Somebody who wants to know where you are all of the time, somebody who criticizes your other friends, someone who criticizes your wanting to be among your family members, somebody who wants to tell you what to wear, somebody who wants to dictate what you like and what you don't like, someone who ridicules your perspectives and your preferences. That's about power and control.
And so, Barbara, the power and control eventually leads to violence.
It can. One of the things I wanted to add to Anne's answer to that last question is that oftentimes at the very beginning of a domestic violence relationship, we don't know that we're involved. It's very seductive. There are an awful lot of attacks to self-esteem. There's attempts to isolate geographically or even just socially in the local area. And typically, as women, we tend to excuse those things away because we're the keeper of the relationships.
What does that mean, isolate geographically?
Well, out by where I live in Gallup, there is a tremendous rural population. People who live on the reservation, it might be 2 or 3 miles between homes. So it's easy to do that geographically. Living on the outskirts of Albuquerque. But you can also just isolate someone socially. You can be in a big town like Albuquerque and not be allowed to go see your friends, not be allowed to go see your family, only be allowed to go to work and return because the mileage is being checked. So there's a lot of ways to isolate somebody. And it's a type of violence, but it's not physical. So it's easy to excuse.
But eventually it does turn to violence.
Yes, after a fair amount of time. It's very rare that once my partner and I marry, there will be violence that happens immediately. Typically, it's a long time before the violence actually happens. The physical violence is what actually alerts us to the fact that there's something terribly wrong. But prior to that, there's been a lot of non-physical violence that's been occurring.
Okay. And so, Anne, we don't want to stereotype, but are there some psychological predictors of an offender who could eventually become violent?
Well, I don't know if there are predictors. I know that one of the things we did in the family court, the court clinic, ran a program where they tested both domestic violence perpetrators and the victims of domestic violence, and then offered up therapy sessions for both sets. And the data they collected showed that there were sort of two major categories of offenders. One were the males who were these sort of dependent, inadequate personality types. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you had the sadistic, aggressive sociopaths. And the conclusion that they reached was that with respect to the sociopathic personality disorder, psychology doesn't have any cure for them. We don't know what to do with them. It seems that about the only thing that makes them any better is time, meaning that when they hit somewhere between 50 and 60, their energy levels go down and they don't have the energy to be as violent, aggressively violent to other people. The other kind of person, the dependent, inadequate personality, those people are actually pretty amenable to treatment, long-term therapeutic intervention. Those are the guys who you'll hear an awful lot of stories about domestic violence that occurs during a pregnancy. And those are people who are not in touch with their feelings. They don't know they're having feelings. They don't have words for their feelings. They don't know how to talk about their feelings. So they act them out. And, of course, when a pregnancy occurs, their own dependency needs are in jeopardy. And that triggers the dependency reaction that they have, and they lash out.
Let's talk about some of the early warning signs. When I was in my 20s, I was dating a young man who, at times, I would get really angry with him. And there was an incident where I got really angry with him. And I'm not proud to say this, but he was facing me, and I was yelling at him. And I remember a point in my mind where I thought, you know, I've seen in the movies where a woman is angry and she slaps the guy. And I remember having that thought and thinking, well, he deserves it. I have a right to slap him. So I looked at him, and just out of the blue, I slapped his face. And it was really frightening to see his reaction because he was totally shocked. And his immediate reaction was to grab my arms. He grabbed them, and he held me very tight. And we were deadlocked in this stare. And I realized that I could be in a lot of trouble and didn't know how he was going to respond. And he took a deep breath, and he released his hands, and he turned away from me. So I have a couple questions about that. One is to talk about the impact that the media does have on our behavior and how I felt like I had a right. I felt like it would be some sort of dramatic thing to slap this man. Anne?
Well, I mean, the media models all sorts of things for us. It gives us the visual model and the verbal models for how to deal with disagreements. And the sensible way to deal with disagreements is to talk them through. That is not very dramatic, and it's not going to sell very many products. And after all, that's what most of the media is about, is selling products and therefore getting viewers. But that's the way our media works. I mean, you look at all of the even the Lara News Hour. Their way of dealing with a disagreement is to have two people who disagree. They sit next to each other and they interrupt and shout and yell at each other. And when you're all done, you can't judge what's going on with either one of them. That is what's modeled everywhere. Right. In popular media.
Right, so there's no gray area.
There's no gray.
So, Barbara, what would you have recommended if you'd heard a young couple tell that story? Do we need treatment?
I don't know so much as that you need treatment. It bothers me that you make a statement that I felt like I had the right to slap. We don't have a right to hit anybody. We have a right to defend ourselves. We don't have a right to aggress. I think it was a good wake-up call to sit down and talk to each other about what just happened here and how frightening this became. Treatment, not necessarily. One of the therapists that I supervise in Gallup brought to me an article written for the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapists that talked about typical couple violence. And it distinguished between what they call typical couple violence and domestic violence in that most couples have an incident of pushing out of frustration, just shoving somebody back, not hard enough to go through a window, which I would consider more domestic violence, but then able to control themselves and walk away, staying in touch with the fact that I'm angry about something that just happened. Domestic violence is more about I need to control you so that I feel better. And that's why I'm doing my control.
This is Peace Talks, and we're talking about preventing domestic violence with Barbara Lambert, director of Choosing Harmony, a batterer treatment program in Gallup, and Ann Cass, a retired judge who served in Albuquerque family courts for 18 years. A lot of people in society are confused, you know, why wouldn't a woman just leave? But to me, it makes sense that a woman would feel afraid to leave her partner because of all the threats, because of the economic control, because of the social isolation. She might not have any other supportive relationships. And there's also society's denial. I've seen friends with black eyes and said, what's that about? And they've said, oh, I walked into a door. And then there's a tendency to just let that go, to not really push the issue, to not want to get involved. In fact, many women leave several times before they can permanently get out of the relationship. So let me ask each of you, how can we all as society help survivors feel safe to leave?
Personally, I think we need to take our heads out of the sand and call a spade a spade. A black eye is not I ran into a door. So we need to say, I notice you have a black eye. What can I do to help? How is it that you're being hurt? Give somebody the opportunity to talk. Let them know, even if they want to deny that there's anything going on in the relationship, that you're there for support. And if they need to talk, that they can. If they need to put things like copies of medical papers or social security cards or an extra set of clothes for her and the kids, that your place is willing to do that, that you'd be happy to find out information about the local shelter or have someone from the local shelter come and talk to her. If we don't say this is a crime and this affects more than just the man and the wife, okay, or the two intimate partners, then we collude with the batterer and say this is okay. And we tell her she has to stay.
I actually think that if you've had the misfortune of getting hooked up with a sadistic, aggressive sociopath, you're in trouble. And one of the things that I find troubling about the way we've been dealing with domestic violence in the criminal justice system is that we don't use the psychological tools we have to tailor-make the kind of result that we need. If you take a sadistic, aggressive sociopath and convict him of a fourth-degree felony, he's going to spend something less than – and it's his first conviction – he's going to spend probably a year, maybe two max, in jail or in prison. And all that's going to do is make him meaner, angrier, and smarter about how to be it.
So do judges know the diagnosis and they can make a distinction in terms of the
– I don't think anybody's doing diagnoses.
Okay.
I mean, we have these statutes that are written in broad terms, and you have a domestic violence conviction, and it's your first, second, whatever conviction it is you have, but it's your first conviction. I don't think they even test them out. But, I mean, the simple fact is that if you've got a sadistic, aggressive sociopath on your hands, from my point of view, the appropriate sentence for someone like that who has harmed another person is until you're 60 years old, however long it takes for you to get to be 60 years old, because that's how long you represent a danger to other people.
And how does a person become a sociopath? Is that nature or nurture?
Boy, probably both. Probably a combination thereof. But, I mean, if you're talking in the criminal justice system of having that kind of a sentence, until you're 60 years old, I think the criminal justice system would just raise its eyebrows and shake its head and say, oh, you know, that's absurd. So the best thing you can try to do is to stay away from the sadistic, aggressive, sociopathic personality disorder. And let me tell you, those people are really, by and large, very charming. They are verbally bright.
And it will be very difficult to identify them because they are so charming. You wouldn't have a clue that the person that you're dealing with is someone capable of incredible violence towards you. But also with the dependent, inadequate personality that you talk about, it's still the most dangerous time for a woman is when she leaves, at that moment and shortly thereafter. And that's from both parties, probably more so from the person who's the psychopath or the sociopath. With a dependent and inadequate personality, we're talking about that attachment problem that I mentioned earlier. I need something from you, and if you take it away, then I'm going to fall apart because now I'll be alone. And I'm going to do everything humanly possible, which is the purpose of the honeymoon stage in the cycle of violence, to get you back so that you can meet my needs because I'm not capable of meeting my own. I never learned how to do that.
So tell me what goes on in the treatment program. What do y'all talk about and what do you do?
When they first get into the program, I ask them to tell me the story and to tell the group the story about the incident that got them there so that everybody's on the same page. And it sort of takes away that terminal uniqueness that people have. Most people are embarrassed to be in a group. I don't want to be because I'm not like those people. But then as soon as they tell their story and I ask others to raise their hands about whether or not they did something similar or if there were drugs or alcohol involved in their incidents, it takes some of that terminal uniqueness away, and then they can start interacting with one another. I have a lot of people ask me, why 52 weeks? And for me, 52 weeks is important. During the first 3 months, most people, whether they're men or women, are minimizing, denying, and blaming to their partner what happened. If only she'd. It doesn't make any difference what it is. It's her fault. From about 4 to 6 months, they're quieter. They're starting to take in more information. They're starting to pay attention a little bit better. They're focusing. They're more relaxed in the setting. From 6 months to 12 months, we have people asking questions, practicing some of the techniques that are going on, mentoring the new folks who are coming into the class, saying things like, I used to be just like you when I got here, but I did this. So they're beginning to take responsibility. For me, anything less than 6 months simply doesn't work as well as it could. You need to have the length of time so that people can break through the denial and say, yeah, I did this. It's very shaming and embarrassing to come into an open public setting like that and say, I beat my wife or I pushed her through a window. So it's important that they have some time to feel safe in the group so they can start talking with one another about what happened.
And what is the evaluation showing? Are you all collecting data, or have programs in California seen what the results are?
That's a great question. And right now, there's very little data on the efficacy of a 52-week program.
What are you seeing anecdotally? What kind of stories could you share in terms of people's successes?
In California, I had a couple of the women call me up and say that they were so glad that their husband had gone through the program. There were tremendous improvements in their behavior. I've gotten Christmas cards from some of the men saying that they were really glad that they'd come to the class. If you're asking if this is a cure, it's not a cure. I can't guarantee that someone will be nonviolent after coming through the class sessions. I can tell you that during the class, typically what happens is the physical abuse diminishes significantly. But along with that, other forms of non-physical violence escalate. The verbal abuse, isolation, using children as weapons, male privilege, a lot of those things continue to escalate, which is another reason why I need a 52-week time period to help them understand it isn't just physical when we're being violent with one another.
This is Peace Talks, and we're talking about preventing domestic violence with Barbara Lambert, who's the program director of Choosing Harmony, a batterer treatment program in Gallup, New Mexico, and also Ann Cass, a retired judge who served in Albuquerque family courts for 18 years. We've invited some community members into the studio to listen to our conversation. Let's see if there are any questions from our guest. If you could give us your first name and then your question or comment.
My name's Ron. Domestic violence seems to me to be like a symptom of this larger culturally sanctioned psychological and emotional abuse, the sorts of things we see in Little Leagues, teasing, the sort of horrible things that go on in families. If, in fact, domestic violence is the culmination of a larger cultural problem, how do you even begin to deal with that cultural problem that produces domestic violence perpetrators?
That's a great question. I guess my response to that would be that we have to help the community wake up. We have to have people start paying attention to things like the language that we use, the kind of commercials that we're seeing, what it is we let our children watch, what kind of things we ourselves as adults buy into. An example of that would be, when did a romantic past become, he hit on me? You know, we have to start paying attention to those kinds of things. It's like, no, it's not okay for him to hit on me. It's okay for him to ask me for a date or to have a romantic pursuit. We have to educate our daughters about what charming men do, and that needs to be up to the fathers. Mothers can't teach that. It needs to come from the fathers.
See, and I come at it from a much more basic level. I think that dominant coercive power is the curse of America. It's probably the curse of a lot of places, but it really is a curse here. And I think one of the things that we need to do is to help people who hold dominant power and all of the people who are struggling so hard to get dominant power understand that dominant power hurts everyone, including the people who hold it. And to take away, to undermine, to change the attitude about how important it is to be number one. I think one of the things that we need to deal with in America is, for example, the coach who said winning isn't everything.
It's the only thing.
It's the only thing.
Yeah, Vince Lombardi.
Vince Lombardi. I mean, it's those kinds of things that are said with some sort of respect. That statement should be met with sadness, because winning isn't everything, and all too often winning is about making someone else lose, and winning is about having power and control over other people.
So there's some kind of shift needed. I mean, we do need leaders, but we almost need them to shift the style of power or the style of leadership that they're using.
Yes. I mean, the idea of leading through empowering people to understand and come forward, as opposed to leading through domination.
Anybody else have a question?
My name is Tristan. I think sometimes when we think about treatment of domestic violence, I know in my head, I immediately think about what action the legal system is going to take to make abuse stop or to remove abusers from an abusive relationship and make it better. But I've heard and read in magazines lately debates about just when that intervention should take place and where family and friends are no longer given the voice that they normally would inside a household. How do you determine where that boundary is?
Well, there are a whole bunch of systems. My own thought is that at any time that any system has a concern about domestic violence in a home, there should be a mandatory reporting to a social system, and that the social system intervenes. If there are children in the home where that concern has been raised, those children, I think, should be placed in an educational program, an intensified educational program, to help them deal with what they've observed, to come up with a different way of dealing with stress, to be able to talk out their feelings. So I would activate and put a whole lot more emphasis up front, and to do it on a social system that is an education system, that's an intervention system and not a punitive system. But that's not the way we function. We let people go on and on and make these mistakes until they cross over a line, and then we come in with the criminal justice system and the penal system, and we're not happy with the results, and it's because we're doing the cure or trying the cure, and we do nothing on the prevention.
Barbara, do you have anything to add?
I do. There is a mandatory reporting system already in place. I just recently looked up the codes, and every person in the state of New Mexico is considered a mandated reporter for child abuse. Domestic violence going on in the home. Children are present, whether they're eyewitnesses or ear witnesses. They're in another room in the house. That's considered neglect, emotional neglect. The problem is that when we report that to Children, Youth, and Families, it's very difficult to get action on that. So there is a mandated reporting system, but we're not always getting consistent action on it. And if we do get action, it's given a very low priority instead of something that needs to happen right now.
We're coming to the end of our program, and I want to ask each of you to briefly recommend any books, websites, or any kind of resources that our listeners might look to for some more help on this topic. Anne?
I would say to people who are in these kinds of controlling relationships to file for a civil protective order at the courthouse. Always know where the shelter, nearest shelter to you is. And probably one of the most useful books I think anybody can read is The Dance of Anger, because I think that really can help empower you to understand what you can do to take charge of your own life.
Internet resources, if somebody wanted to go onto the internet and use their browser, just point to Violence Against Women. You will have thousands of websites that you could go to. Donald Dutton has written three books that are very helpful. One is called The Domestic Assault of Women. The other one is called The Batterer, A Psychological Profile. And his last book is called The Abuse of Personality, which sort of explains even more of what he talked about in The Psychological Profile of the Batterer. If you're dealing with a Native American population, such as I do out in the Gallup area, a book that I would really consider mandatory reading is Eduardo Duran's book, Postcolonial Psychology of the Native American. It's really excellent at trying to put together how the influx of white European settlers have interfered greatly with the culture of the Native American and how they interact with one another, and how that also has set them up for violence among themselves.
We'll list those as well as some other materials, links, and excerpts from our program on our website, which is peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio, written as one word, .com. I'd also like to give the hotline numbers for New Mexico, 800-773-3645, and the national hotline number for domestic violence, 800-799-7233, or call local law enforcement. We'll put those numbers on our website as well. I'd like to thank Barbara Lambert, Program Director of Choosing Harmony, a batterer treatment program in Gallup, and also Ann Cass, a retired judge who served in Albuquerque family courts for 18 years. Peace Talks is a production of Good Radio Shows Incorporated and was recorded in the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque. Producer and engineer is Paul Ingalls, music by The Eagles and Allie Adelman. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.